From the late 60s to the mid 70s, radical politics gripped the West like it has not done, like it hadn't done for decades, and it hasn't done since, really. And I'm going to show you a video that will hopefully give you a sense of why, you know, and the way that the Vietnam War, the struggle for Black liberation, the generalized student revolt, the kind of feeling that was in the air that meant that, you know, millions of people could pretty rapidly transform into revolutionaries, into people who believe the whole system had to be overthrown. And I really hope this will work. Oh, I'm going to need to reshare it. I forgot about something. Hang on.
Tell me, what do you think about sending troops to Vietnam?
Oh, I think it's a good idea.
Well, if it's going to protect Australia, I think it's worthwhile.
I think it's got to be done.
Oh, well, I think it's necessary.
Well, I think it's quite the very best thing that can be done.
Well, I hope that gives you a little bit of a sense that people weren't crazy for thinking we need a revolution. That's the liberal analysis when you read about Maoism in the Liberal Takes, for example, a recent book that was brought out and written by Julia Lovell, who's a Guardian commentator, Maoism, A Global History. Her argument is basically people just went crazy and they learned to love violence. I think this is a pathetic explanation for why millions of people became radicals. Although, as I want to point out in this talk and explain, it was a tragedy that Maoism was the dominant politics to take root amongst this layer of very rapidly radicalizing people who had grown up, as you see, in that 1965, you know, up to 1965 period, in a very conservative time, and who very quickly realized they needed to change the world. People became mad about Mao.
Tell me, what do you think about sending troops?
People became mad about Mao. There were Mao caps, suits, placards, and posters. And in Sweden, with a population of less than 4 million at the time, 100,000 copies of Mao's Little Red Book, the Bible of the movement, were sold in 1968 alone. Partly, Maoism could appeal to millions of radicalizing people because it bore an abstract resemblance to genuine Marxism. It said that the war was not a mistake or simply immoral, but an imperialist war produced by the capitalist system. And that's true. It said, you know, that Black people must join the global revolution in the fight against oppression, racism, and capitalism. That's true. You know, and it said the communist parties had sold out on revolution and become rubbish. And that was true too. You know, if we look at the communist parties in the West, a big reason why people turned to something different. The Communist Party in the United States, for example, tailed right behind the Liberals of the Democratic Party and the very most moderate forces in the civil rights movement. And so, for example, when the movement against the Vietnam War began, the Maoists demanded get US get out of Vietnam, and the Communist Party slogan was "Stop the bombings, negotiate." You get a real strong contrast there. If you're young, newly radicalizing, you know which one would appeal to you. In Australia, where the workers' movement was a lot stronger, the Communist Party ran some significant blue-collar unions, but it did so in highly bureaucratic and reformist ways that scarcely marked them out from the Labor Party. And this photo from Brisbane gives a feel for the bureaucratic control that the Stalinists desired and the contempt they had for the students and other radicals who did not follow their lead. This is Brian Laver, not a Maoist, but a young student radical in the 60s who's being muzzled by a member of a hack from the Communist Party as they try to give a speech to protesters. And in France, the Communist Party was biggest by far and led the whole union movement. And it supported French colonialism in Indochina and Algeria. And it saved the right-wing government in 1968, which we saw some footage of. It saved that right-wing government after it was nearly toppled. And it ordered the workers back to work after the biggest general strike in history. So the pro-China splits could seem like the more radical alternative. Yet Maoism was a form of unreconstructed Stalinism with third world and heroic flavouring. It took on some further idiosyncratic inflections as it passed through the hands of Western students, radicalised overnight, rightly impatient, and sadly lacking any older layers of revolutionaries who could fan the flames of this radicalism but also help them work it out along the way. Now, people remember today what I put in the video: the cool clothes, the street fighting, the brave youth. And so I've tricked you a little bit by setting the scene in that way, because the real history of Maoism is a lot less romantic than this. Obviously, the question, you know, is begged, what is Maoism? And, you know, what is Western Maoism? Well, it was an absolute grab bag of things. You know, they had, on one hand, super hyped up rhetoric, bombard the headquarters, imperialism's a paper tiger, defeat the four olds, political power grows out of the barrel of the gun, people's war, go on forever and ever. On the other hand, they were very conservative. They had very Puritan attitudes to drugs, sex, facial hair, and, you know, non-overall-based, you know, fashion. Some of them were so workerist that they ordered their members to get jobs as campus canteen workers rather than organise the anti-war movement exploding on universities. But others were extremely hostile to Western working classes, believing they were part of the problem and had to be defeated from without, you know, by a nuclear bomb if necessary. They worshipped authority, Mao's in particular, and built highly bureaucratic centralized organizations where no debate was allowed, you know, like the traditional Stalinist parties. But then many also argued for spontaneous outbursts of political violence and worshipped the Cultural Revolution as a libertarian uprising against bureaucracy and tradition. So can we understand Western Maoism as a single phenomenon? Yeah, I think so, broadly speaking. And the best place to start is at the beginning. So the Chinese Revolution in 1949 was a blow to imperialism, you know, something to support in some ways. And it sent ripples throughout the world Stalinist movement. You know, most Western communist parties were marginal and repressed. This is the height of the Cold War era. But now here was another state they could look up to as really existing socialism, which now, you know, covered apparently a third of the world. And had gotten there in sort of a unique sort of way that made it interesting and appealing to them. You know, Stalinists in this case had set up red bases in the countryside. They'd won the support of the peasantry. They'd built a huge militia out of them, defeated the foreign powers and the corrupt government, and captured the cities from the outside. And in the end, they wound up with a state pretty much identical to the Stalinist regime in the USSR. So, you know, all friends here, basically. But then the leaders of the USSR throw an absolute bombshell into the mix. Stalin dies, and his successor, Khrushchev, gives a secret speech that gets leaked to the leaders of the USSR. He says, actually, it had all been true. It wasn't just Western Trotskyite propaganda. Stalin had been a tyrant and a brute. He'd had all the revolutionary generation butchered and he'd built up a ruthless police state for himself. And maybe, says Khrushchev, it was time to peacefully coexist with capitalism for a long time. And perhaps there was a different path for socialism in the West through a gradual parliamentary approach. Now, the main effect was that tens of thousands of members in these Western Stalinist parties were shocked by the revelations about Stalin, demoralized, and left overnight. And for the remainder, the vast majority were in favor of the even more moderate and openly parliamentarist approach. This is something they'd been practicing for decades anyway. But then came China. And Russia and China had been in an increasingly tense relationship over all sorts of things because they're just two capitalist powers, really. Aid, territory, China's worried the USSR was going to leave it out in the cold for a rapprochement with the US. And so China launches, an attack on Khrushchev that gets increasingly hyped up as the years go on, culminating in a split in the early 1960s. So now, not Mao and Stalin, it's Mao on his own. But Mao does say Stalin did nothing wrong. He was the greatest socialist ever. It was Khrushchev who was betraying Stalin socialism. He was a revisionist, a term you'll see all the time if you read about Maoism. And in fact, he started to suggest maybe even capitalism had already been restored in Russia. And so Mao was pitching himself and China as the only truly revolutionary country left, upholding the legacy of Stalin and implacable hostility to world imperialism, apparently. USSR didn't even want to use the nuclear bomb. That's how soft they'd gone, according to Mao. So for a very small minority in the Western Stalinist parties in the early 60s, there was something comforting about the idea that China was holding the line on all the ideas that they'd been trained in for so long. And that's why they much more referred to themselves at this time as Marxist-Leninists, not as Maoists per se, because that was the state ideology of the USSR, pioneered by Stalin. And especially middle and high-ranking bureaucrats of these parties who didn't want to throw out the cult of leadership, the tight centralized chain of command, the strict obedience to dogma. They're the people most attracted to this formation. And, a bunch of them had been to China to meet with Mao and attend the party school in Beijing and so on. Here's one of them, a huge hack in the Australian Communist Party based in Victoria called Ted Hill. You get a sense of some of the enlightening discussions he had with Mao throughout his life in this slide here. He was a total yes man, and he had to have someone to be a yes man too. And if it wasn't Stalin, it would be Mao. And that's the thing. These people thought if they broke now, they could be the tin pot leader of their own little group, and they'd be the first ones in and they'd get the official backing of the Chinese state. So this is the leader in Australia, and he took a very small but important group of trade union officials with him to form the Communist Party of Australia hyphen Marxist-Leninist. Whenever you see hyphen ML or even ML is like an abbreviation people will use, this means usually a Maoist split in a party. And so here's two of the big names to split in Australia. Clary O'Shea, who's shaking hands, and he was the head of the Tramways Union in Victoria. And actually his jailing in 1969 led to a watershed moment in Australian working class history. And the other guy's Norm Gallagher, who I'll mention a little bit later. In America, it's similar. You have a hack named Milt Rosen, and he lost an election in the American Communist Party and said, fuck this, and split off to form a group called Progressive Labour. In France, it's a little bit different. There's some students influenced by a so-called anti-revisionist theoretician called Louis Althusser, and they try to win ideological recruits within the Union of Communist Students, the youth wing of the Communist Party, and eventually they're expelled and they form the Union of Communist Youth ML, UJCML. Okay, well, what were these groups like in the early 60s? We might call it the first wave of Maoism. Okay, well, Progressive Labour, to be honest, out of all of them, they started out with real gusto. You might call them activist Stalinism. They were very outward looking and they were recruiting young people through highly energetic campaign and propaganda work. So in the Harlem riot of 1964, their newspaper with this cover on the left was wildly popular amongst rioters, basically became the poster of the uprising. And a leading black member who's there on the right fronted court for supposedly inciting the riot. And this gave them quite a lot of cred. According to some reports, they organized some of the first demonstrations in America against the war in Vietnam with the slogan I showed you earlier. And most sensationally, they sent a delegation of students to break America's blockade and sneak into Cuba. Again, a really high-profile event. And many of them were arrested on return, and they actually sent another round even bigger into Cuba. The French, the UJCML, in good Maoist form, they set up, you know, Vietnam base committees in different suburbs of Paris to educate and agitate against the war in Vietnam. So similar sort of vibe and strategy. Now, on the other hand, you have another kind of way of doing things, which is the CPAML, and they are highly secretive and conspiratorial. So you don't know who's a member at this point. And Ted Hill even talked about finding places in the mountains to hide and practice guerrilla warfare, which was, you know, sure to be the key question on the order of the day for the Australian working class. But these groups have some things in common. They're all intensely workerist, which is like a really crude, fetishized, idealized way of thinking about workers' struggle, political struggle in general, and so on. So, for example, Progressive Labour, when a months-long a student strike rocked San Francisco University in 1968-69, there was some footage in the video, and the demand was for a black studies department and more black students. They labelled these objectively reactionary and pro-imperialist demands because black youth would get a better education in the class struggle working factory jobs, and they'd just get brainwashed if they went to university. Like, complete madness like this, you know. In France, it's, you know, very similar vibes, very hostile to students. So they took the advice of Mao to serve the people and to come down from the horse to observe the flower. And this meant leaving the universities and getting jobs in the toughest blue-collar factories or going out to live among the people for weeks and months to basically collect survey data on their lives. These are actual Maoist strategies. This is not based on, you know, a strategic assessment that the working class was radicalizing at that moment, needed to be organized or whatever. Really, it was quite a moral position that proletarians were better than students and the latter needed to be purified of petty bourgeois individualism. And basically what happens is activists are wrecked by the physical labor and deeply disappointed that they didn't find an immediately receptive audience to their hyped up rhetoric. And this led to a lot of disillusionment, dropping out, you know, often sometimes very rapidly to the right. And then you look at their actual union approach at the time, you know, it's just sort of revamped Stalinism. They're trying to bureaucratically capture the leadership of the French unions, and, you know, just thinking that the problem was that the current officials were the revisionists from the old Communist Party instead of the anti-revisionists. So a very opportunist and bureaucratic approach there as well. Okay. They're also very sectarian, and this means actually that this first wave of Maoists basically completely failed the test of 1968. In France, you know, you have 1968, one of the most significant student worker rebellions of all time. And at that time, the UJCML is in a faction fight or in an inter-party fight because there's some other group with Chinese backing and they want it. And so they're desperate to prove their proletarian credentials. And so they purge themselves even more of their students. And so when the students revolt in Paris, they denounce it as reactionary and petty bourgeois. And so they have nothing at all to do with 1968. Progressive labor in America, actually, as the movements get stronger, they back out of them. So as the black movement gets more radical, they denounce it. The anti-war movement, they denounce it, even though they helped to start it. And they, you know, they cover this with all sorts of ridiculous Maoist rhetoric, like saying, we've got to back out of the anti-war movement, even if it's getting massive, because imperialism is a paper tiger. It's about to collapse anyway. So we've got better things to pass on. And they focus all their efforts on just trying to raid and take over a group called Students for a Democratic Society. I'll get back to them in a sec. But basically, by the time they've done that, they split that apart. It blows apart. Then the high point of the movement in America. So they screw themselves, they blow themselves apart, they fail the test completely, just as things are about to get much better. Now, there's a second wave of Maoism, which starts with 1968. And the sad thing is, even though that first wave screwed up the test, they were organized and they passed the baton of Maoist ideas over to this next generation to give them a set of ideas that are going to totally fail the test as well. So there's the Cultural Revolution in China. And this, you know, in this, Mao agitates for students to join his bureaucratic faction fight against his rivals, using all sorts of romantic language about upholding revolutionary values, sweeping away the old and purifying ideas and culture. And so this challenges a little bit the extremely sectarian anti-student attitudes of the Maoists, because, you know, you take the Australian Party as an example, they kind of realize that if they're not going to intervene here, they're not going to be able to recruit people to their tiny secret group. And Mao even tells Ted Hill, you know, you should go to the universities and take a look. And so Ted Hill gives a talk saying, you know, actually maybe students could be a really revolutionary layer like they were supposedly playing in China at the time. So this is really where Maoism starts to take off, especially overwhelmingly among students. Now, one thing that could attract students to the Maoists was their flamboyant tactics and dramatic flair. And in one notable incident in Australia, the Maoists at Flinders University in Adelaide announced they were going to publicly napalm a dog. And when there was outrage from many pro-war members of the public, the Maoists made the point that these people didn't give a shit that it was happening to thousands of men, women, and children in Vietnam, which is an excellent point. And they didn't napalm the dog, obviously. But the thing is, the Maoist students in Australia were really characterised by ultra-militant confrontational tactics. You know, you had to get into fights with cops at every demonstration or it was useless. And you can see in the video, you know, that temptation and that tendency is already sort of there. This was the so-called hit on the head theory of radicalisation. You know, all it took for students to go from liberals to revolutionaries was a good bashing. You know, occasionally these things would have a galvanizing effect on protesters. It's not always wrong for confrontation. But much more often, and much more in accord with Maoist ideas, it meant protests would, turn participants into spectators of the heroic minority of Maoists and who'd get their faces and names in the press. And for these self-promoting radicals, this descended into a cycle of confrontation retaliation. Instead of actually building the mass moratorium marches against the war, most of their activity in the late 60s and early 70s at Monash, where they were the biggest, and La Trobe University, revolved around getting disciplined by the university for political activity. Then they occupied some building, then they got reinstated or they lost and they needed a new round. And as it went on, more and more students understandably lost interest in this sideshow where the Maoists were the heroes and the actual anti-war campaign was forgotten about. And it's important to know this confrontational approach was not restricted to demos with cops. The Maoists around the world were notorious for their great willingness to use physical violence against their rivals on the left, overwhelmingly the Trotskyists. In France, this shock doctrine and voluntarism reached a peak. After their failure to intervene in 1968, the dominant trend withdrew from factories and pretty much all public activity, and they just turned inward to the study of Marxist-Leninist dogma and ever more rigid party structures into oblivion, basically. There was a minority current, a sort of unique one. They took the view that the Maoists had been wrong to oppose the student uprising and abstain from the fighting, and they had a sort of anti-organizational edge to them almost, highly voluntarist edge, which, yeah, means like you just do things by sheer will. You don't care about objective conditions or the pace of history or anything like that. And this trend, which called itself left proletarian, gauche proletarian, and its paper, Cause of the People, became the most publicly recognized face of Maoism in France. They saw spontaneous outbursts and especially violent ones as a force that would drive the revolution forward. They were particularly attracted to some aspects of May 68 in which, and June 68, in which factories saw shootouts between workers and police. They loved flamboyant acts such as hijacking a truck full of luxury goods to distribute amongst the black and brown ghettos of Paris. And they completely boycotted the trade unions. And they said they were resolutely opposed to unions, that these things were just institutions of capitalism. They considered any bread and butter organizing basically to be inherently pro-capitalist. Now, the interesting thing is at the very beginning, this didn't leave them completely 100% isolated, because in the fallout of 1968 in Europe, you know, the Communist Party has crushed it and controlled the workers' upheaval from within. You know, places like Italy, they're playing disgusting roles as well. So there were many young radicalized workers who were disgusted with the unions and, older CP activists and stuff. And a bit of a mood that you could bypass the old union machine and these reformist forces and just sort of lead through militant minority actions, especially very confrontational, violent ones. But this emphasis for the Maoists on the poorest, most oppressed workers, who they got a little bit of a hearing with in France, like the Algerian workers and poor immigrant workers and so on, it wasn't about their belief that this layer could be convinced of Marxism and then leave the whole working class behind it to take power through seizing the means of production themselves. So in a polemic against the Trotskyists, the GP argued that the only two essential conditions for revolution are the support of the masses and the gun. So really, for them, these groups, they were just the most risible group, you know, the most likely to want to resort immediately to violence against the state. And for that reason, you know, they looked to any layer who might do this, the students or the lumpen proletariat or even farmers unhappy with the government for right-wing reasons, to whom they sent members to live amongst and serve. Now, these tactics of workplace sabotage and violence were a disaster. The French state banned the organization and hundreds of activists were imprisoned over the next few years. The GP had its newspaper banned, which is why the famous, you know, philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre had to become the editor of it and sell it, because the government wasn't willing to arrest France's most famous intellectual and Nobel Prize winner. But the GP didn't let up on its ultra-left tactics. And in 1972, a young worker member was murdered at Renault factory by security there. And a whole layer of workers were sacked. And in response, just maddeningly and crazily, the GP has kidnapped and held the hostage, the boss of Renault, for 48 hours in a secret location, and then were even forced to release him without winning their demands. This kind of, yeah, semi-terrorist activity was the death knell of GP, the belief you could just push things forward. Most workers reacted with disgust, and the rest of the far left even couldn't stomach supporting them. So the organization completely disintegrated and there was widespread demoralization. Now, in a country with a strong workers' movement like France or Australia, you can't get away with calling yourself left-wing and rejecting the working class. But in America, Maoism that came about in the second wave was very strongly characterized by this hostility to the working class. Anti-war students who were organized in Students for a Democratic Society increasingly felt they were hitting their heads against a brick wall. You can see how quickly they're beginning to radicalize. On the left is their liberal origins, you know, blah, blah, pacifism stuff. And then, you know, a couple of years later, oh my God, pick up the gun sort of stuff. So they're desperately searching around for a set of ideas that they hope will just fall out of the sky and solve all their problems for them. And at the same time, they're fighting that old Maoist group PL, who wear suits and ties and piss everyone off. And so they feel the need to out-Mao the Maoists. And actually, to do this and to fight their old rivals, they ally with the Black Panther Party, because the old Maoists, you know, hate all the black power people. And they ally with the Black Panther Party to denounce the Progressive Labour Group as racist. And then SDS splits pretty clean in half. Progressive Labour, just, they fall apart. They just become a group who sells their newspaper outside factories. They have no idea what they're doing. They're just a small sectarian grouping. And then the new Maoists, who'd allied with Black Panthers and so on, they start to fragment into all these competing vanguard groups. And the key thing about this new wave is that their belief is the central contradiction in the world today, and this is much more sort of the flavour of Maoism as it goes on, is that the contradiction is not between the working class and the ruling class in each country, but between the first and the third world, so-called third worldism. So as Vietnam begin to win the war against the US, it's a brilliant development. It encourages this belief that the world revolution is going to be a struggle between nations and not classes. And just as Mao had conquered the cities of China from the countryside, so too would the cities of the world, i.e. like the first world countries, would be defeated by the countryside of the world, the entire third world. Now, three huge problems with this. First obvious one, you're worshipping all these brutal regimes overseas so long as they call themselves communist. Second is, it obscures the fundamental class division between workers and bosses in the first world. So these new generation of American Maoists saw themselves as behind enemy lines. You know, the white working class in the US, they're bought off, they're part of the problem. These are the groups pioneered the phrase white privilege we all have to bloody live with today, leaving a toxic legacy of anti-solidarity that we still have to deal with. For them, only black and brown people in the US are called third world people. Were revolutionary and would pick up the gun when the world revolution came home to roost. And this is just because they're like a third world nation in America. That's how they see it, not as like a particularly a militant section of the working class or whatever. So white revolutionary is just like deferred to these groups. You just got to like, you know, you got to morally appeal to whites to give up all their privileges and sacrifice for the world's oppressed. You can't build a movement like that. But that's what they tried to do. So the racial struggle was the primary contradiction in American society for them. And racism absolutely was one of the central questions of the day. It was going to be one of the most radicalizing issues. If you didn't have things to say about that, you're a moron. But racial oppression is about dividing the working class. And that overcoming that division was not really how they saw things. In the Maoist third world view, you know, black people are an eternal third world nation colonized by white imperialism. And this was based on a very slavish adherence to the US Communist Party line in the 1930s that said black people must have the right to form a separate country in the South. So that was sort of a pretty silly argument in the 30s of the Stalinist Communist Parties. It was ridiculous by the 60s because most black people had moved to the cities of the North. They weren't fighting to form their own little country in the South, but they just stuck to this line and could not see the idea of black workers leading the working class struggle absolutely as the vanguard. Overwhelmingly, they're the most radical, most politicized by everything going on, but that they'd have to win white workers over. And that actually means building on the common interests as well as the special the particular questions of racial oppression, those two things together. Actually, they didn't see it like that. And so also this meant that in the US, Maoist groups were basically built on racial lines. You had black Maoist groups, Latino Maoist groups, Asian Maoist groups, and therefore you had white Maoist groups. And America was an extremely racially segregated society, even more than Australia. So it's not totally surprising that in a politicization, groups start to form along these lines, but they made a virtue out of it and never really tried to overcome it. And this nationalist logic that they had led to some really bizarre places. So the biggest Maoist group, the mostly white revolutionary unions, in the 70s ended up going to Boston to fight the introduction of busing, which was a measure of desegregating schools. And they opposed this as a form of racial dilution of black communities, just because a few black nationalists were against it. Because of their politics. Actually, most people were for it, and it was pretty obvious where you needed to line up. So imagine you're a white Maoist in Boston. This is the cover of your newspaper, and next to you are actual Bostonite Nazis organizing also to, what is it, Smash Boston Busing Plan. Yeah, like absolute madness. Not every Maoist group settled on that, but actually a lot of them were confused and couldn't see the fucking obvious point because of their distorted view of what racism really was in America, seeing it through the third world lens. And another important thing is this idea that the third world people, so-called, of America were the only revolutionary people. It caused constant splintering accusations and counter-accusations of racism. It's just, you know, self-criticism circles, you know, which were adopted straight out of China, where they were a form of extreme, you know, totalitarian abuse. Well, these were adopted and they became a beloved navel-gazing and browbeating practice of the Maoists. You know, you had to get all that racism out of you. You had to get all of that petty bourgeois individualism out of you. And the irony is that these are actually really practices reflecting the individualist origins in the student milieu of these Maoists, you know, which isn't something to bloody, you know, kill yourself over. You're a student. Well, actually, student radicals can play an important role. But the reason they had such a moralist fixation on their own personal qualities is because they saw themselves as the self-appointed leaders of the revolution. They didn't have a democratic theory of revolution. They were the ones who were going to lead it. Any party calls itself the vanguard, they're the ones. And it's all in there in Mao as well. So you're the leaders. So it's about what you do. It's about the kind of person you are. All of history is just about the kind of person you, the kind of leaders there are or whatever. So that's, you know, that I think gels with this real fixation on people's individual characters and intentions rather than classes, objective interests, mass struggle, democratic debate, and so on. And also these hyped up moralistic accusations of racism and self-purification and stuff, it's not hard to see how those kinds of things remain with us today in identity politics. Now, even where Maoists did intervene in the workers' movement, as we saw a little bit in France, they took contradictory but extremely dead-end approaches. So I've talked about the sectarian one of the so-called, like, you know, unions are just a burden on the backs of working class. This is from the Australian saviors as well. They're powerful weapons in the hands of the capitalists, and they just advocate for, like, red unions that only organise workers who accept their party line. This is meaningless because you have your revolutionary party, but the unions are mass institutions. They involve all workers, regardless of their political views, who elect to join a trade union because they're about joint struggle. And through that, you know, you can win people politically to your ideas, but you have this separation between the political organization of revolutionaries and the class organization in trade unions and so on. But that's that sectarian line, but they have another one as well, which they also get from Stalinism. You know, a very opportunist one. The Maoists had a theory of cross-class alliances called the Bloc of Four Classes, straight from Mao and straight from the two-stage theory of both Mao and Stalin. So the claim is, before the struggle for socialism, many different revolutionary stages can be concocted. You can make up any stage that needs to be achieved before socialism. It's very useful for a bureaucracy that doesn't want to get there. So, for example, you might need to have an anti-colonial revolution first, or an anti-apartheid one, or an anti-fascist one, or an anti-imperialist one, and so on. And then later, some point, you'll have the socialist one. And in these first stage revolutions, it's not just workers got to lead it. It's not just workers got to be the force behind it, but everyone except the most reactionary section of the ruling class. So even the capitalists who call themselves progressive and so on are going to be part of this so-called bloc of four classes, or popular front, as it was called in the Stalinist days. Now, this is a useful framework. It allows for a lot of manoeuvring, a lot of opportunist practice. And so it meant that alongside their sectarianism to unions generally, the Maoists could also form alliances with senior trade union officials, or even have them as senior members. So I mentioned Norm Gallagher before. He's a long-term Maoist who sent goons into the New South Wales branch of the BLF. He's the federal leader of the BLF. He sends goons into the New South Wales branch to bash it up and destroy the militant and democratic wing of the union there. No contradiction, apparently. He's just part of the Bloc of Four Class. But the thing is, the Bloc of Four Classes and two-stage theory really came home to roost amongst the Australian Maoists in a particularly crazy way. As they increasingly abstained from the anti-war movement and then the campus struggles, they became characterised by one particular feature. They were very intense pro-Australian nationalists. According to the CPAML, Australia was an oppressed nation under the thumb of US multinationals. And all classes in Australia had to fight, unite to fight for Australian independence, which led them to lead maybe the most bizarre campaign of all time, which was take the Mickey out of Moomba. Mickey Mouse had been crowned king of Moomba, which was a disgrace that showed Australia was under the thumb of US imperialism. And there's a quote there. By all means, let's have a children's hero as King of Moomba, but let's make it Australian. So the campaign was to make Blinky Bill the king of the Moomba Festival. And I'm reading this out after extensive research. I still need to, you know, maybe put my glasses on to check this is what I'm reading. And they also toured around talking to farmers about the dangers of Japanese investment in Australia. Very good. You know, so they basically tried to win a generation of anti-imperialist radicals to a form of patriotism that's pretty difficult to distinguish from Pauline Hanson. And, you know, they got this radical vibe, but they're actually quite strong social conservative. They have a real streak of social conservatism as a force. You know, they make their members wear suits and ties, shave off their mustaches, and swear never to smoke dope and so on. And so sometimes these neat, straight-laced Maoists would go to factories like good proletarians, and all of these young, long-haired workers were like, are these cops? You know, and they also had like a pretty hostile attitude to the women's liberation movement, basically arguing like working-class women had better things to worry about and that this was just simply middle class. But that was nothing compared to their views on homosexuality. They were intensely, intensely homophobic. And here's a quote from the largest Maoist group in the US in the 70s. Bourgeois society breeds and promotes homosexuality to degrade and enslave the masses of people, and it will be abolished. Gay liberation is anti-working class and counter-revolutionary. Its attacks on the family would rob poor and working people of the most viable social unit for their survival. Absolutely crazy. All right, start to sum up. I've gone on too long. When everything's going up, up and away, your politics can seem correct because they're resonating with a highly energized and radicalizing layer of students. You know, people looked over to what was happening in Vietnam and they felt they had to do something. The Maoist groups waded into this feeling to argue you could do pretty much anything, whatever you like, any group, any layer, and so on. But as these expectations of immediate revolution start to butt up against stubborn reality, a lot of your layers fall away extremely rapidly. Their rapid but shallow conversion to radical ideas meant that they could give up on the idea of revolution as quickly and easily as they had picked it up. For example, their hyped up denunciations of the Communist Party, you know, they say the USSR become revisionist, state capitalist, fascist, Hitlerite, social imperialist. These are all just terms of moral abuse for the Maoists. They're not theoretical analytical tools and understandings. Nothing had actually changed in Russia from when you had high Stalinism to when Khrushchev makes his speech. Because the USSR was actually state capitalist and imperialist, but it was Stalin and Stalinism and his destruction of workers' democracy that had made that happen. And those were the days that the Maoists longed for and that they supported going on in China, the kind of torture, murder, and exploitation of Mao's dictatorship. Now, the real clincher is when Mao welcomes Nixon to China. Because now China liners who have to follow the twists and turns of China are ordered to back the US against the USSR, which apparently was the greater, more fascist imperialist power. China backed apartheid South Africa forces in Angola, opposed Bangladeshi independence from the military dictatorship in Pakistan. They supported NATO. They supported General Pinochet. They opposed Puerto Rican independence in America. They called for more US military bases in the Philippines. This is the kind of madness that it led them to. And there were plenty of hacks who were completely trained to be obedient to China who went along with it, but for most it was too much. But they just shifted their alliance to someone else, Vietnam, Cuba, or Albania, or whatever. It showed their starting point was the interests of some state somewhere. The ideologies they upheld and introduced into social movements were the ideas of authoritarian ruling classes, not ideas of exploited and oppressed people seeking liberation. And most of them moved into forms of reformism and so election campaigns like Jesse Jackson in the Democrats later. This is all they did. But I've gone on too long, so I'll be very quick now. You compare it to the tendencies on the left that, yes, they had to shrink in the 70s when there's a decline in the struggle like everyone else, but they definitely didn't implode like the Maoists do. By 1980, Maoists don't exist anymore anywhere in the West. In particular, the tendency that us in Socialist Alternative draw on, the International Socialists. These Trotskyists built up organizations with a rich tradition of internal debate, and they developed the theory of Marxism, state capitalism, permanent arms economy, you know, the trade union bureaucracy, third world revolution, and what that really represented, and so on. And by comparison, even the Maoists of the time admitted that they contributed, quote, almost nothing to the theory of socialism and the history of the working class movement. It's just a tragedy who they could take all these thousands of people who radicalized, and they could burn them up. They could turn them into the Pol Pot support group, the Blinky Bill Brigade. You know, they could get them to act absurdly in the working class movement, drive people away, focus on intra-party struggles, burn themselves out like this, leading everyone into not just one dead end, but many, many dead ends. And so this is a tragedy we have to remember. And the final point of that is they could do this not just because Maoism was an attractive idea to students. They could do it because there already were these pre-existing forces that had been organized and cohered around a set of politics and were ready to intervene. And the results, when that set of politics was so terrible, were predictably just as terrible. And it's an argument to build a real Marxist tradition in a living organization that's ready for a new generation of passionate, curious, and sincere radicals who want to change the world.